From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern Bureau in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. Our election coverage continues today, and we're looking at the 96th State Assembly District. And joining us are two candidates in that district. First, we'll hear from Josephine Janes, the Democratic candidate. Then we will hear from the incumbent, Republican Lauren Oldenburg. First of all, Ms. Janes, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We should point out your district encompasses a few counties in La Crosse, Crawford County, Vernon County, Monroe County. That would include a pretty wide area from Prairie du Chien to Soldiers Grove all the way up to Viroqua, Westby, Lafarge. You've got not the cities of, but areas near Sparta and near Toma as well. So a pretty big district that you want to cover. Why don't we start by talking about you, who you are, and talk about your experience and what made you want to run for state assembly.
Yeah, so I'm Josephine, and I worked on the Paul Burr campaign 2 years ago, and I watched how the gerrymandering and all that dark money that poured into the district, I watched how that contributed to Paul's loss, and I was just really disheartened. I've been involved and engaged in politics and government for a really long time, and in watching that, was really heartbreaking. And when I heard that Paul wasn't going to run this time around, I thought, who would be another candidate that I could throw myself behind 100%? Who was someone that I could believe in? And I thought, why not me? Why couldn't I run? Why did my age have to disqualify me from running? And I spent months meeting with community leaders and deliberating whether or not I would run, and here we are.
So you referenced your age there, but you didn't say it. You're a recent high school graduate, and you are 18 years old, running for state assembly. You've successfully received your party's nomination for the race. So talk about, you know, what you have, I guess, what you've faced campaigning in terms of, have people been accepting of such a young candidate?
They have. I think people really understand that. You know, I'm going to bring a fresh perspective and a new energy to the legislature. You know, my generation might not have the opportunity to run when we're middle-aged. We might not have the opportunity to wait. You know, a lot of the issues that we're facing, they need to be answered now. And especially with COVID, my generation will be one of the hardest impacted by COVID. And the policies that are being created today, they have long-lasting impacts that will affect the world that my generation inherits. And I believe that we deserve a seat at the table. And I'm not only running to represent my generation, but also my community. You know, I was raised in this community, and I just want to serve them. And, you know, I'm committed to working with both parties to achieve what's best for the residents of the 96th.
So talk about the issues that you want to bring up. If you're chosen to head to Madison to represent the 96th district, what are the two or three top priorities that you'll have in the state assembly?
So I'm really passionate about creating an economy that attracts our young people to not only stay in the district, but if they do leave, to come back to their home district to settle down after, you know, attending college or trade schools. You know, I firmly believe that the hardworking youth raised in our communities are one of our most precious resources, and we need a vibrant economy to attract them. And that really encompasses a lot of different issues. You know, we need to invest in small businesses, and housing our communities is really key to creating a space for employees for our small businesses that are growing. We need affordable daycare, clean water, not only for our health, but also for our, you know, our booming sportsman and tourism industries. We need to make sure our schools are funded, that our family farmers can stay on the land. There's really a lot of issues that are encompassed in that.
One of the issues that's going to be really big in your area is agriculture. And we've heard a lot over the years about family farmers, and they've really had a tough time recently, not just in light of COVID-19, but just in light of economic conditions that make it more difficult for them to operate. And yet in your district, Big agriculture plays a role, to say the least, as well. How do you balance the priorities of making sure businesses that bring a lot of tax dollars to your area through the products that they produce and sell, but also, you know, having a level playing field or creating an environment where smaller family operations can thrive?
Yeah, we really need to work to ensure that farms of all sizes can stay on the land. You know, our district is, you know, our identity is, you know, our family farms. I was actually at the Dairy Expo when our Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, said, "Get big or get out." And that's not what our farmers want to hear. You know, we have a federal government who's actively working against our farmers. And that it's impacting my district. So working to make sure that on a state level we do all that we can to ensure that these federal policies that are hurting our farmers, you know, to make sure that we can keep our farmers on the land.
So in terms of looking at the economy, it's not just agriculture that that affects the economy in areas that you're from. What other economic concerns are you focused on?
Right now, it's just, you know, making sure that our communities emerge successfully from COVID. You know, there's a big fear about our main streets, you know, keep making sure that we have our small businesses can thrive. And in Madison, you know, I want to make sure that when relief packages come through, that our rural communities aren't left behind.
So what can be done to help those people who are left behind? And who are those people who you think currently might be being left behind?
Well, I think in Madison, just generally our rural communities. We see it with broadband. You know, that last mile is always the most expensive mile. Well, that last mile is my district. We see it with our school funding. The funding formula right now disproportionately affects rural schools. It's our rural communities. That's who's being left behind. And we need to have a legislator in Madison who's willing to fight for our communities.
Rural broadband is an issue that's come up in a number of the interviews we've had with both Republican and Democratic candidates this year. And it's one that's important because of highlighted because of how much time many students in many districts had to spend learning online last school year. Talk about why rural broadband is important. Do you see a lot of people in your community without internet access?
Yeah, and broadband is not only important now that we're seeing for, you know, education and for telemedicine, but also for agriculture and tourism. And broadband plays a huge role in making sure that, you know, people stay in the district. In this world, people need to be connected. And it's not just for, you know, social media anymore. It's for everything. I think the best way to solve our broadband issue is to treat it like we did rural electrification in the 20s and 30s. You know, having the funding go to our local utilities who know the area and know what needs to be done.
So you would, rather than kind of wait for the powers that be to find a way to do it in which their company is expanding broadband to rural communities because it suddenly makes financial sense or because there are subscribers that they haven't reached yet that they might have thought too expensive before, you would favor a program that allows government funding to be used to expand the infrastructure?
Yes. You know, I think it's important in this day and age, we need to make sure that all of our residents are connected. All citizens should have, you know, equal access to broadband, because right now we're seeing it with COVID, like you had said. With children working at home, or with children doing schooling from home and parents working from home, we need to make sure that everyone's connected. It's vital.
We're talking with Josephine Janes, who's the Democratic candidate in the 96th State Assembly District, and she will face the incumbent, Republican Lauren Oldenburg, on Tuesday, November 3rd in the general election. Our conversation will continue in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio, and if you'd like to hear part of this episode again or stream any of our previous episodes, you'll find them at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. Our program continues after this. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse, and we're talking today about the 96th State Assembly District, which features a race between the incumbent Republican Lauren Oldenburg and the Democrat Josephine Janes. And of course, the general election is on Tuesday, November the 3rd. Ms. Janes, we have had an opportunity to talk about quite a number of subjects already, but I want to get back to education, because it's not just broadband access that's important to education, but you talked about the funding model and the way it affects rural school districts as opposed to school districts that are nearer a larger population base. Talk a little bit more about that and what you would like to see change and how you as a state legislator could affect that change.
Yeah, so with school funding, we have a formula set in place to ensure that, you know, our property taxes don't go up. And that's great. That's really important to keep those spending levies. But the issue is that those property tax caps were imposed in the early 90s, and they were only meant to be imposed for about 5 years to rein in overspending from bigger school districts. But our rural schools got locked in with their conservative spending budget, and they never changed the formula. So now our rural schools are, you know, disproportionately affected. And people have had to take it upon themselves to raise their own taxes, if you look at, like, the referendum trend of the past 5 years. So we need to work with groups like the Association for Equity and Funding and the Fair Aid Coalition to make sure that we adjust the formula so that it will help schools across the state.
So you talked about the inequity, as you see it, being affiliated with taxes, and that's not a popular thing in legislatures across the country. Nobody likes to talk about raising taxes. It's a bit of a third rail. So how do you gain ground when you talk about potential tax increases in order to raise more revenues for school? People like schools and they like good schools, but raising taxes is just a non-starter for so many legislators.
Well, and that's why, you know, that's why these caps are good, because they, you know, that's why they call it like a property tax freeze. So it's a great thing to have in place. What needs adjusting isn't the taxes, it's the formula of how that tax revenue is spent to make sure that all schools have an equal chance of, you know, getting that money. It's not a question of raising taxes, it's about adjusting the formula, because the present formula isn't working.
When you look at the other issues that are important to rural communities, something that often comes up is health care. I know there are some areas where you have to go miles and miles to get to the nearest hospital. What would you like to see in terms of health care in your community and the rest of the communities that you would serve as a state legislator?
First of all, we need to accept our Medicaid expansion dollars. That is our money that we paid taxes on, and now our government won't take it. Our legislature won't take the money, and that's unacceptable. That's unacceptable. We're losing out. And then also, you know, a lot of our rules, we need to safeguard our rural services. You know, corporate greed is quick to consolidate and eliminate, and we need to ensure not only the jobs, but also that these services stay local. You know, our local clinics and nursing homes and hospitals. You know, no one should have to drive an hour to visit their grandparent or to receive a life-saving service. So making sure that these services are funded, we see a lot of our nursing homes and clinics are underfunded, so we need to adjust the Medicaid reimbursement rate so that they're receiving the proper funding that they need in order to stay local.
I want to turn to the environment right now, because that there's so many ways in which our conversations about the environment affect the business community, especially rural agriculture, business, people using recreationally those environmental resources that seem so plentiful in Wisconsin. What's the biggest issue facing the environment in our part of Wisconsin as you see it?
Flooding. I mean, everyone who lives here knows that something has changed. We face these 100 or 500 year floods every 2 years. And we have to, you know, rebuild and then get ready for the next flood. And it's not practical. It's not working. So we need to work with our local communities and our local governments to help, make sure that our infrastructure is secure, that the dams are secure for the next flood. And flooding is the biggest environmental issue in this district.
So when you're talking about the infrastructure, you're not talking about infrastructure within communities that might be affected by flooding. You're talking about actual infrastructure that is used to contain waterways when there is excessive amounts of rain or what have you.
Yeah, like we have numerous dams throughout the district, and making sure that they're, you know, up to date, and so that they can be of help with when the flooding occurs. And we need to make sure that our communities aren't constantly devastated.
So what would you like to see happen in terms of evaluating and changing what needs to be changed? I mean, do you have specific ideas in mind about what changes need to be made to the various systems that are used to contain the water and keep it out of our city streets?
I think the most important thing for me as a legislator to do is to listen to the local governments, because, you know, every community is different, and working with them and what they need when it comes to flooding is most important, and having those ongoing conversations.
There's been a lot of focus in recent times on issues of racial disparity and equality, and we've seen a lot of voices brought to the fore that we maybe haven't focused on or maybe have ignored over the years. And so as a legislator, I know, you know, because of your age, because of your gender, I know that you may have faced certain aspects of either discrimination or at least have been in a minority in many aspects of seeking office and being interested in politics. But what could you do as a person in the legislature to bring those minority voices to the table so that they feel like there are more diverse voices being heard on important policy matters in Madison?
The most important thing is listen. Make sure that I'm listening to their concerns, especially when the policy decisions are about that. You know, as someone who isn't a person of color, listening to them, I'm not a member of the LGBTQ community, but listening to individuals and learning about how certain policies will impact them. Just listening to the minorities to make sure that all voices are heard and all voices are represented.
Let's go back to an issue that you raised earlier, which is you've talked a couple times about people, young people your age deciding to leave the state. I mean, you're 18. A lot of people would normally be deciding where they're going to go off to college and leaving either the immediate area where they were raised to go to a nearby college, or even going to a college out of town or out of state, and then possibly never coming back. And in some places, this is called like a brain drain or something like that, where communities have trouble attracting young professionals to their areas. What do you think the area here in southwestern Wisconsin would need to do to make sure that we're retaining those resources, those young people who are from our community who might try to be looking for a reason to leave?
I think, most importantly, to get young professionals to come back to our area, we need some rural economic development. You know, we can't just focus on labor jobs. We also need to focus on our small businesses and things. I think in our district right now, we're facing kind of a housing shortage So to ensure that there is opportunity for our small businesses to expand, they need, you know, housing to attract those potential employees. And when people want to, you know, raise a family, they need to make sure, you know, one of the first things people often look for is good schools and affordable daycare to make sure that young families can come back to the area.
So affordable daycare, how is that accomplished? I mean, I think a lot of people, not to give voice to the opposition, but to play the devil's advocate a little bit, a lot of people might say, you know, I mean, if you get a job, you pay for the daycare that you need to get the job. That shouldn't necessarily be a subsidized thing or something that the government pays on your behalf. Is there a way to do that other than assigning it to some government agency to pay for?
I don't necessarily think we have to have the government be paying for it, but I think just making sure, you know, daycares are like a small business. So to ensure that we have providers in the district so that young families can afford to work. That they can afford to put their child in daycare. I think that's just really important, especially for, you know, kids who can't be in school yet. And we see, like, during the summers, families struggling with what to do with their children because both parents work and not everyone has a relative nearby who can, you know, babysit. So just making sure that we have options for families is important.
This has been an interesting campaign season to watch from the sidelines. I know you have not campaigned for office for yourself in the past, but you talked about having been involved as a volunteer with other campaigns. So talk about how this campaign season has been different and how difficult it has been, or maybe not, to get your word out to people, get your message out to the people that you're trying to reach.
It has been difficult. We've been trying to use, you know, social media, and then other forms of media like newspapers and radio to try to reach, make sure that all residents are being able to hear our message. But we haven't been able to door knock because with COVID, you know, I work at a local nursing home part-time, and I'm very conscious of the most vulnerable in my community. And door knocking just isn't an option. And it's especially hard when not all candidates believe in the same way that I do. So we see candidates who are, you know, door knocking and going into people's houses and putting our community members at risk. And I don't feel comfortable doing that. So I have to compete with trying to leverage, you know, media and do mailers. And one thing my campaign has done is I say that I want to be accessible to all individuals. So I have my phone number and my email address listed. So I always encourage people to call me or to email me. You can find those on my website, JosephineJanesForWI.com. You know, I'm trying to have these conversations with people in safe ways.
So as we close our conversation, give that thumbnail sketch of why somebody might be interested in voting for Josephine Janes for State Assembly.
I'm firmly grounded, you know, in my family and my faith and my community. And I'm at a unique place in my life where I'm able to commit 100% of my time and my effort to serving this district. You know, we're currently facing a time in our country where, and our world at large, where we have to act on our strong community values in order to address these extraordinary issues that are created by this pandemic. And if I'm elected, I'll bring a fresh perspective and new energy to the legislature with a, you know, strong desire to build a bright future for our district for many generations to come. And I hope that others can see that vision with me. So I hope that, you know, we can use our collective voice to create an energetic, common sense blueprint to restore economic prosperity to our district.
Josephine Janes is the Democratic candidate for the 96th State Assembly race. And she's facing Lauren Oldenburg, the Republican incumbent. And that election is, of course, on Tuesday, November 3rd. Ms. Janes, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
and this is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear part of this conversation again or stream an episode on demand, you can visit our website for that. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. There's a way to get in touch with us if there's an issue that you'd like to hear about in the future as well. So go to that website, wpr.org/newsmakers. If you want to take our program on the go, you can download your favorite podcast platform and search for Newsmakers and hit subscribe in your favorite podcast platform. I'm Ezra Wall. Newsmakers continues in a moment right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse Bureau. Thank you very much for listening today. Our focus as we continue our election coverage is on the 96th Assembly District, and the race on November 3rd for that seat is between the incumbent, Republican Lauren Oldenburg, and the Democrat, Josephine Janes. And we heard from Ms. Janes earlier in the program, and we turn our attention now to Representative Oldenburg. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Well, thanks for allowing me to join you, and appreciate the reach out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell people who don't get to hear from legislators every single day a little bit about yourself, kind of where you come from and what qualifies you for another term in public office.
I lived and grew up here in western part of Vernon County, and I'm a fourth generation farmer, still on the farm here. It's been in my family for 142 years, so I'm a lifelong farmer, dairy farmer until I got elected back in 2018. I did sell my cows, but I still have the rest of the farm that I do farm. A little bit of past history as far as work experience or schooling. Graduated from Viroqua High School, went on to college at UWL for 3 years, and decided that wasn't for me and came back here and farmed with my dad up till his passing and until I bought the farm in 2000. And then always had the kind of the need or the itch about for business. So I actually ended up being in a little bit of politics. I ended up being on the local town board in the mid-90s, also 2 years for town chairman and that. So that was a good experience as far as local politics. I believe local politics is a very important part of the political realm and government in this country, especially the state of Wisconsin. So my experience there has really helped out this first couple years down here in Madison. Then I got on the Chaseburg Senex board, the service co-op board down here in Chaseburg. I was on that board for 19 years. I was secretary for a while, then became president of that board. And then also was on the Westby Creamery board. I was on there for 14 years. And president for my last 5 years, had to lead that because of term limits. So a couple local co-ops. I'm a local guy. I believe in a local, buy local, support local. And I also just that knowledge of doing that co-op. I'm a true believer in co-op and how businesses run, and I really enjoyed that. And so, you know, when this opportunity came up for the 96th district 2 years ago, I thought, hey, I think I'm qualified. And I jumped in and I won. And I appreciate and thank the people that supported me through my first run, and I'm looking for that support in my second run.
So you talked about your activity in local politics before you got into politics on the state level. What was it that first attracted you to public service?
Well, it kind of goes back a little bit in history. My dad, he was local town chairman for 4 years, and then his dad, my grandpa, was actually an assessor for our town of Harmony, where we live, and he also became chairman at one time, too. So it kind of runs in a little bit of the blood, you know, and I'm always willing to help and help people. And when people reach out and ask you, you have to really think, okay, is this something I can do and want to do, and can I fulfill that requirements of what it takes to be on a board? And I'm a true believer, you know, when you sign up or you get elected for a board, you put 100% in it. You know, you don't say, okay, half-heartedly, you put 100% in it, and that's who I am.
So if you're granted another term in the state assembly representing the 96th district, what are the top, oh, let's say two or three issues that you would like to tackle in your second term?
Well, you know, I had an opportunity to be part of this last year's budget, and we did put $44 million into the broadband. And with this school last spring, some of them are doing right now going virtual. High-speed internet is is critical out here. And we have to continue to address that issue, either with money or infrastructure, however that looks, you know, number one for schooling, number two for the growth of businesses. As we all know, back in March and April with this COVID-19 hit, everyone was working from home using broadband, and, you know, and it's like found out if you had good enough high-speed internet, if you had it at all. So I think though that is the number one thing, that, especially out here in the rural district like I serve, is broadband, availability for broadband, for schooling, and also for business and business growth and entrepreneurs who wants to, hey, you know, I think I can conduct a business from home or local and still do well way everything is getting done on over the internet. And I think, you know, that is one of my, you know, big one, and unemployment. I mean, I've dealt with unemployment issues here for the last 6-7 months, and we continue to deal with that. But even before the pandemic hit, businesses were looking for people to work. There is still a lot of job opportunities out there, so we have to get people connected with where the employment is. And I think the rural areas, any way we can help out to do that with the broadband education and connecting that way. And I had a great opportunity to champion youth apprenticeship funding through the budget process. In the last budget, put $5 million more appropriation into that program. And that's a great opportunity for kids that maybe don't want to go on to school or right away, that can learn some trades and get out in the workforce sooner and quicker, and possibly don't have to have that high education expense, but actually, you know, help and stay in local community.
I remember in the 80s when I was growing up, the emphasis was on how many kids we can direct to that university track and how to prepare them for that. And then lately there's been a shift in that focus, realizing that there are many, many very viable jobs that can provide well for a family that don't require a bachelor's degree, but instead require some sort of technical education or a trade-related education that students might be more interested in certain communities. How can we provide those resources for students? You know, you mentioned that college wasn't for you after a few years.
Right, right. And 100% agree, because I graduated in 84. I mean, that you were pushed and almost looked down on you if you didn't go on to college. You know, and that was just emphasis, like you said and stuff. Number one, you know, through this youth apprenticeship, the school signs up to it, and then an employer, and there is some dollars going back to the school to kind of implement and kind of keep track of that part of it. And that is one way, and any way we can connect the employer with the student to, hey, this might be something. Even if you don't go in, say a CNA, if you want to go, hey, I think that's interesting, you get the credentials, go in and do it and realize, oh, this is not me. But that student or that gets to learn the soft skills of what it takes to be employed. And that is vital and goes on. And that person didn't need to spend a lot of, you know, 2-3 years in college figuring out, oh, that was not for me. So those are huge. And we just have to connect up people. And anything we can do at the state level through the youth apprenticeship or other programs, I'm all for it and 100% behind it.
So let's go back to the other issue that you mentioned, which is rural broadband, and that's across the country a huge issue, but especially here in Wisconsin, the expense related to establishing that infrastructure where it doesn't exist. In the city, you sign up for high-speed internet from whoever it is that provides it, and they've already got all of the material running to your street. They just have to run it up to your house, which isn't very expensive. But in rural communities where there might be fewer potential customers, what's the government's role in making sure that infrastructure is set up so that when a potential customer calls them, they're not looking at thousands and thousands of dollars of extra expense just to get the cable running up to their street?
Like I said earlier, we put $44 million in a budget, and those are grants. You know, so local companies or local providers for high-speed internet or cable can apply for them. And so that's part of it. You know, possibly different technology, your hotspots, your towers, there's possible ways of that going on. And then even at the federal level that they're actually putting money into it too. So those are kind of different avenues that we have to look at. And I think there's possibly some things that, you know, I think has to happen at the federal level. Right now, you are considered 25 up, 3 down as for a high-speed internet. And some of that can be provided on copper. But once you throw 2 or 3 devices on it, your speed really slows down. So I think maybe some what's considered high speed has to be looked at and really scrutinized and say, hey, maybe we have to bring up the standards a little better, consider what high speed is.
We're speaking to Loren Oldenburg on Newsmakers today. He is the incumbent in the 96th Assembly District here in Wisconsin. He is a Republican. He's running for re-election against a Democrat named Josephine Janes. And our conversation will continue. We're just scratching the surface, and we've got several more issues to address, including the economy and agriculture and healthcare and more. And we're going to do it all coming up here on Newsmakers. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can find all the information you need at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. The program continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Bureau. Thank you very much for tuning in. Our focus today is the 96th Assembly District and the race for that seat, which takes place on Tuesday, November the 3rd. Representative Loren Oldenburg is a Republican. He's the incumbent in that seat, and he faces Josephine Janes, a Democrat, on Tuesday, November 3rd. So our conversation with Representative Oldenburg continues, and we'll turn our focus now to the economy. Big deal, as we all have faced COVID-19 and its impacts. But in the rural part of our state where Representative Oldenburg serves, the farmers out there have been really facing it for multiple years. So talk about just the climate right now, Representative Oldenburg, for trying to make a living on the farm and what that's like and what challenges there might be for the legislature to address.
It's been a yo-yo effect. I mean, when this COVID hit back in March, you know, the prices were kind of going up, and I'm kind of emphasized on the dairy side of it right now, and they dropped like crazy. And then all of a sudden they spiked the highest cheese prices, record cheese prices. So been kind of yo-yo affecting because restaurants closed down, more people are buying from the grocery store. So that supply chain had to kind of change. You know, the marketing had to kind of change. So I think they've addressed a lot of that, and prices are kind of leveling off a little bit on that. We were able to ask the governor to put $50 million from the CARES Act money into kind of a grant program, really. So if a farmer made more than $35,000 of gross income from the farmer, he was eligible. And that could about 23,000 farmers in the state of Wisconsin would qualify that. But only 14,000 sign up. They were all given a $3,500 check, and that's really helped as far as, you know, kind of bridge that gap as far as what's going on in the farming industry. Then he reopened it again and had about $9, $10 million left over, and anything over 10 people that did not apply already, anything over $10,000 gross income, and that was the last part of August that they were able to sign up. So hopefully, I've not heard how many people signed up. Hopefully that money got out to the farmers there, and definitely in need and definitely helped on that. So a little bit more optimistic going on right now in grain prices. Soybean prices are coming up, and then corn is creeping up a little bit too come harvest time. So things a little bit more positive out there. Had a good year as far as getting the crops in, and weather has been fairly well. Got a little dry here in the first part of August, maybe took the top ends off the yields and beans and corn. Hay got up in good quality this year and seems to be, you know, a little bit more better supply going into the feeding season. So a little bit more optimistic because didn't have to deal with such wet weather we've dealt with for the last 3-4 years. So the crops got in, getting harvested in a decent time, and I have to deal with so much mud. So that's kind of going on right now in the dairy industry. We passed several bills at the end of the session in February to help out the farmers. I think one of them was a bill that will give a tax credit to farmers that have, on their outbuildings. That would, I think, would have really helped some of the farmers and financials as far as putting, you know, putting a little bit more dollars in their pocket. But that is sitting in the Senate right now, along with the water task force bills. There's like 13 of them that we passed. That's sitting in the Senate also. And one of the bills that I championed was the processing grant bill. I took it off the governor's request of the state of state, and I kind of amended it a little bit to emphasize any processor doing 50 million pounds or less would get grant money, available for grant money, and that's also sitting in the Senate too. So that's kind of stuff that we done last year, and I'm sure we'll have to address some issues possibly going up. Truth labeling bills, I was one of the authors of that one, one of those bills. Even emphasizing even more, you know, buy local. I think through this pandemic, I think buy local was something I think thrived, and I think it will continue to thrive. So anywhere we can help out at the state level to buy local, support local, I mean, that's a win-win for everyone.
As we see the conversations taking place across our communities about racial equity and about how some people have felt left out of our system over the years, or that they've been left behind by our economy, or that they've been mistreated by our society, it brings to light the importance of bringing everyone to the table. So what I'm asking you, and what I've asked the other candidates that I've talked to, is what will you do in your next term to make sure that minority voices have a seat at the policymaking table?
Well, I think what's going on right now, the speaker has created a task force, you know, to address some of these issues. And I think education is huge. I mean, education, educating all of us out there that is not, you know, part of that on a daily basis. You know, I look back at my little experience that I had when I went to college, you know, run the farm. And that was my first interaction with other people that don't look like me in a lot of ways. And I learned from that. And I actually enjoyed that part of it and got to be some good friends with people that don't, you know, exactly look like who I am. And I think that's the inner reaction that we have to have, to listen and see where they're coming from and see where we can do better, you know, either through policy, education, and any other avenue that will make that issue, you know, number one, it's heightened right now. Number two is something that we have to address. And once we address it and find good solutions or good policy to do it, this country and the state of Wisconsin will be a better place for everyone to live.
I want to talk about flooding. You mentioned getting a lot of water in the last few years and how this year was much better and that people had an opportunity to get good crops in. But flooding is a major issue in the part of the state that you serve. Constant, at least the last several years, just constant issues with overburdening the watershed areas there and it leading to all kinds of damage on farms and in communities and in people's homes. What needs to be done to address what's leading to that flooding?
Well, we're very fortunate that we in my district, in the West Fork of Kickapoo and the Coon Creek, got a federal grant survey, and it's about almost a $2 million survey, which is going on right now. I'm going to a meeting tonight, and there's one tomorrow in Coon Valley that looks at all those two watersheds, looks at what's going on. You know, should these dams be replaced? Should more be put in or less? Are they located in the right direction? Even we'll look at the farming practices, you know, and where these roads are. So I'm very excited, hopeful, and that something comes out of this survey that's something that we can look at and say, hey, we can do this. Because we have to address, you know, all aspects of flooding, you know, try to keep that water on the surface when it lands, you know, and try to prevent these floods getting to be at the catastrophic level to try to prevent the damage that it does create.
So. I want to talk about healthcare because that's something that has come up. Obviously, anybody who has ever had to interact with our healthcare system, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, has experienced some level of difficulty at some point in life. And all of us who have loved ones want them to receive the best care that they possibly can. And yet there are real disagreements between people about how that should be accomplished. It's an issue that keeps coming up in our conversations on both sides of the political spectrum. Would you support an effort or be willing to look at an effort to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act?
You know, that's a question that's been was brought up the last few years and stuff like that. And I look at that, you know, when that was presented in this last budget, you know, by the governor and stuff. And when you expand Medicare, you would take that we're bringing about 82,000 more people into Badger Care. Half of those people were already covered under Affordable Care Act or other kind of insurance by the employer. And these are single, non-dependent individuals. So we're not, it's not a huge population that we're addressing. And the thing is, we want to push more people into the Affordable Care Act because they pay 100%. You know, Badger Care is 90%. So, you know, we got to emphasize that Affordable Care Act is there and available, and that's something that we have to address. You know, get that information out to people. Say, yeah, it's here. Look at it. It's subsidized your premiums. But the biggest thing I think is we have to deal with the high deductibles. Do you have your self insurance? But these high deductibles are killing people as far as that goes. And I think something that's more we have to address with than taking the money from the Affordable Care Act, because that is not necessarily guaranteed it's going to lower premiums, and that money does not necessarily go and helps reimbursement rates to hospitals and nursing homes. So,
there are quite a number of people, though. I mean, it's aside from, you know, people that you mentioned who might not have dependents in their household or whatever, but there are quite a number of people who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, and they make not enough money to get some of the lower cost plans that are available through the ACA exchange, or the term is escaping me at the moment. So what has to happen if we're not going to accept federal dollars to expand Medicaid? What has to happen in order to ensure those people who are working because they make too much money to qualify for Medicaid currently?
If you make too much to qualify for Medicaid, you are able to get Affordable Care Act. Anything you make 62,000 in your family, make 62,000 or less, you know, on income, you can get on Affordable Care Act, you know, and get a subsidized premium. So, you know, I question, you know, as far as, you know, that end of it, 94 to 95% of the people in the state of Wisconsin already got insurance and are insured. So, yeah, we have to address the ones that, you know, in that kind of no man's land, and how to look about as far as making sure they have insurance and making sure they have coverage and health care.
So in our remaining moments, I want to give you an opportunity to reiterate some of the issues that are important to you, some of the things that you really would like to highlight for voters who are listening. You face Josephine Janes, a Democrat, in the election on November 3rd. So as people go to the polls, take the last couple minutes we have here to remind people why you think that they should choose Lauren Oldenburg for a second term in the state legislature.
Well, the biggest thing is, you know, the last 2 years have, my last term here down here in Madison, that number one, I got to figure out how everything works down there and gotten that relationship with, you know, my colleagues across the aisle and my colleagues in the Senate. You have to get that relationship and find those people that champion your thoughts, your needs, and the people in the 96 that they need. You have to find that person in the Senate and your colleagues across the aisle to get them across the finish line. So, and I truly believe my experience is number one, working in the legislature, but my experience in out here and working with local co-ops and local town boards, county boards, just that experience alone will, you know, weighs big time as far as coming down and making legislation and bills at the state level and the needs and wants. And I can understand what these needs are wants because I actually lived it and was part of it.
Lauren Oldenburg is the Republican candidate and the incumbent in the 96th Assembly District in Wisconsin's legislature, and he faces Josephine Janes, a Democrat, on Tuesday, November the 3rd. Mr. Oldenburg, thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So if you'd like to see more about our program, if you'd like to get in touch with us or stream on demand a previous episode or part of this conversation that you might have missed, you can do that at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. If you'd like to take our show on the go, open your favorite podcast platform, search for Newsmakers, and hit subscribe. I'd appreciate that very much. Thanks today to John Davis and Dawn Jewell, who helped me produce the show. I'm very grateful to them and for the rest of the lacrosse crew here at WPR. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers, and catch us next time right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.